Previously on Beta.
We all lose.
We all lose, yeah. There's no winning there.
That comedian, by the way, and I think we should put that in air quotes.
I'm standing here. You make the move. You make the move.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, comedian Lori Kilmartin gives us the ins and outs of her stand-up special, Cis, Woke, Grief, Slut.
Some things aren't full jokes. I often open with a little joke-ette or a joke-lit or something where it's just like a little hello.
Also, writer and actor Priya Gunn sits down with us to talk about her very timely debut novel, Your Driver Is Waiting.
I grew up very working class. I grew up very angry. And I am a racialized person.
But first, Ed Zwick. Ed is an Academy Award and Emmy Award-winning producer, director, and writer. He's also had a hand in creating two groundbreaking TV series, 30-something and My So-Called Life. Ed splashed onto the scene when he directed the Oscar-winning Civil War drama, Glory, starring Denzel Washington and Morgan Freeman. Ed received another Oscar for the Western, Legends of the Fall, which featured Brad Pitt, Julia Ormond, and Sir Anthony Hopkins. Unfortunately, there's not enough time for me to mention all the other prestigious awards Ed has earned. If these were the Oscars, the orchestra would have played me off by now. Luckily, he can put his resume in book form, as he has with his captivating memoir, Hits, Flops, and Other Illusions, My 40-something Years in Hollywood. He started as a PA for Woody Allen in the 70s. That led to a spot in the prestigious American Film Institute Directors Program, where he met his longtime and still producing partner, Marshall Herskovitz. As Ed says, meeting Marshall changed his life.
Well, you know, there are certain people that you encounter at different moments of your life that mark you. And those relationships didn't happen to me in college. It just started to happen to me when I came here. Obviously, it was based on admiration. He was hugely talented already. I could tell that, way ahead of where I was, I thought. Very kind. We had a lot in common. We talked about our families. A lot of what the program had to do with was actually digging into some personal history and trying to apply that to the kind of film you wanted to make. And we found a lot of common ground as we began to talk. Before we knew it, we were collaborators. And it's been much more than that, though. I mean, we're talking about a very long time now, and I'm very proud of the work we've done together. But what I'm proudest of, really, is this friendship has just grown, and it's been as much about learning from each other about families and about grief and about big children and about failure and all the things that life throws at you. Having somebody who is that close to laugh about it and to cry with you, and, you know, just we've been that to each other now, and it finds its way into the work. And then we also separate at times and do work on our own.
Yeah, it's almost like would it be fair to describe it as kind of a brotherly relationship? Do you feel kind of
definitely
like
yeah. I have two wonderful sisters, but never had a brother. I certainly think of him as such.
Yeah, and that's clear in the way you talk about him. That's great, and the way you write about it in the book, that your relationship, your friendship. You and Marshall went on to create the hit TV series 30-something. You were on your own dramatic roller coaster in real life as well. How did you draw from those experiences, those real life experiences, for the show?
Well, we had no choice. I mean, when you're confronted by life as it happens when you have kids and trying to run a television show, they inevitably blend. You know, the issues of marriage and ambition and work and the pressures and the need for bonding with each other, it just all tended to become a blur. And no one had done it for television. In television at that moment, everybody was a doctor or a lawyer or a cop. And we thought, that's just not what we're interested in. We're interested in the smaller moments that aggregate into bigger moments. And so we decided to sort of narrow our focus and to try to find what was epic and what was emotional in the familiar.
I dreamed about being a painter since I was a little girl.
And now you're an artist.
Elliot, don't you get it?
No, Nance.
Well, it is back. And it is growing inside of me.
and I can feel it dark and cold like a stone, and I can't stop it.
Nancy, you can lick this thing.
Who are you to tell me to keep fighting?
I love you.
Well, don't.
And the funny thing is now that's what television seems to do all the time.
Yeah. So did you get pushback from the network executives that you were trying to do, that you and Marshall were doing something different with 30-something?
You know, it's funny. We've often done very well working for networks who are in the toilet. And I think at that time, ABC was really at the bottom. And it was not pushback. The pushback came a little bit later when we revealed that our sensibilities were darker, I think, than the network had intended. I mean, I like to think that there was a lot of fun in it and silliness too. But as we went into some of that terrain, there was a little pushback, and we were very full of ourselves, very young, and basically said, what's that line? I would prefer not to, from that story.
Bartleby the Scrivener.
We were Bartleby the screenwriters.
Yeah. It was also around this time when you got a chance to direct the Civil War drama, Glory. You say that there was a moment rehearsing that marked the true beginning of your career as a director. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah. I mean, I think when you start, you're very concerned with control and of over-determining things with the actors. You're so full of anxiety that it blinds you or clouds your vision. And I think when I saw what was happening with Denzel and with Morgan and Andre and Jimmy, I realized that I was in the presence of something really extraordinary. And if I was smart, I would just shut up and let it happen.
What about you there, Buck? Where about you from?
Yeah, I'm around Tennessee. Yeah, ran away when I was 12 years old. I ain't never looked back.
What you doing since then?
I run for president. I ain't win, though.
Sometimes you find yourself in a situation where things are happening that are bigger than you are. And it was the smartest thing I ever did to allow some of that to influence me.
That's very interesting. Thanks for sharing that. Glory features a powerful performance from Denzel Washington. He won an Oscar for his role. How did you two collaborate?
You know, that was the first of several movies that Denzel and I did together, so we didn't know each other well. And I wouldn't say that there was great affinity yet. I think he takes his work very seriously and prepares. And yet the nature of the character that he was playing is very removed from everyone else in that group.
Wanted to say something, sir, but I...
Go ahead.
See, I ain't fighting this war for you, sir.
And he very much kept to himself during the shooting of it. Our friendship really began pretty much after that. You know, in success, there's an opportunity to have a bit of a valedictory, and we traveled with the movie together. I actually remember we went to Berlin together. It was the week after the wall came down, and it was so thrilling. We went to the East with the movie, and it was the first American movie shown in the East in this people's hall of 20,000 people, and it was a movie about people seeking their freedom, and it was just, you know, it was full of moments like that. And then he wins the Oscar and blah, blah, blah. You know, it was, and thereafter, obviously, our families got to know each other and a real friendship developed.
Mm-hmm. One of the most powerful scenes in Glory, if not the most powerful, is the whipping scene. And you write about that in the book about how you worked with Denzel on that. Can you tell us that anecdote?
We were in Savannah, Georgia. We were only miles from a place where black men as slaves were kept in chains. Not long before, historically, there were ghosts, and everybody was aware of them. And Denzel is a spiritual man, and he was feeling that. And also the humiliation of standing there being whipped by a white man in front of hundreds of other men was very difficult. And we did a take, and it was fine. I absolutely could have moved away, but I just felt there was something more. But rather than talking to Denzel, I talked to John Finn, who was the guy with the whip. And it wasn't a real whip. It was a piece of chamois attached to a stick, but nonetheless, it stung a little bit. And all I said to him is, John, this time, just don't stop till I say cut. And as it went past what Denzel was expecting, it became a very different experience where the control was taken away from him as it would have been taken away from him in real life. And I was sitting there next to the dolly grip, and I just waited for that moment when I sensed it happening, and I tapped him on the shoulder, and we pushed in and happened to get there right at that moment when that tear came down, and it was magic. He knew. I mean, he's so smart. And even if that, even if he might have been angry that I was in some sense manipulative, he also knew that it was working. And that's what a brilliant movie actor does. He can somehow maintain those two realities at the same time.
Yeah, and great call on your part. And so, as you just mentioned, he didn't, Denzel didn't, wasn't mad at you for doing that, right? It didn't affect
your
relationship.
No, I mean, there might have been some peak for a moment, but no, he, you know, he's just so intuitive, and he has such a sense of what's happening. And that takes extraordinary poise and confidence and concentration not to break and say, what are you doing? Or that's wrong. Or and also it was actually a subordination of his ego at that moment.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that with us. Denzel would not be the last acting legend you would work with. Your next movie project was Legends of the Fall with acting heavyweights Brad Pitt and Anthony Hopkins. What was your approach to working with them?
Well, they're very different. I mean, Anthony Hopkins is a man from the National Theater, you know, schooled in the classics. And Brad worked his way up from Missouri without training to begin and was very intuitive. And so it was a little bit difficult sometimes finding that common ground. The truth is that Sir Anthony Hopkins loves Westerns.
Yeah, I recognize him.
You got him, James.
This fellow passed by here maybe 4, maybe 5 years ago. Did some work here. He was on his way to San Francisco, he said. He's hoping to book a passage on a boat to Australia.
Australia?
What exactly is he wanted for, Sheriff?
Well, he,
That would be of a private nature, sir.
Private nature? It's a public office you hold there, Sheriff, isn't it? Gentlemen?
All he'd wanted his whole life, as it turned out, was to be in a Western. And he could do imitations of Lee J. Cobb and, Robert Ryan and Wayne and, Jimmy Stewart. And so I think actually it was his good nature that helped us find some sort of voice where it would all work together.
Interesting. And you didn't find out that Anthony was a fan of Westerns until you were shooting?
In rehearsal. He was doing wardrobe and he tried on the clothes and I saw him sitting out in a field smoking this pipe. And I just went out to say, what are you up to? He goes, this is the best moment of my career. He was just a happy camper.
That's great. That's great. While you were prepping Legends of the Fall, you helped launch another groundbreaking TV series, My So-Called Life. This show starred Claire Danes. However, she was only 14 at the time, and you said that her limited availability was a blessing in disguise. How so?
Claire was actually only 13 when we first met her, and nobody had ever done a show about teenagers with teenagers because there are labor laws. Labor laws oblige you to have them in school a certain number of hours, only to be able to work a certain number of hours. And we wanted her to be the star of the show. So how could we do that? And the answer was to expand our vision to write stories that were much more substantive about the supporting characters, about her parents. And that then allowed us to put Claire in the center of things, but still like be in the center of a constellation or of a wheel. And she was the hub.
She's gone. I cannot believe that you let this go this long.
Patty, I forgot, all right?
Oh, come on, why don't you just admit it? You want her to go to this stupid concert.
All right, I admit it, okay? Look, I saw the Grateful Dead when I was 15 years old. It was one of the 8 best nights of my life. Oh, it's something I wanted to give her. Oh, fine, leave, just like he does.
You leave my father out of this.
What? What'd you say?
It's not worth repeating.
But there were all these wonderful sort of spokes that allowed us to fill in that time when she couldn't be with us.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but Winnie Holtzman was a huge help, right, in terms of writing?
We met Winnie. Her brother was Ernie Holtzman was our cinematographer for a couple of years on 30 something. And he said, "Oh, well, my sister's a writer." And your response to that is, "Oh, yeah, great. It's just what I want is another script." But we read her script and it was wonderful. And then we invited her to join the show, 30 something. And when 30 something was done, we just began to talk about doing something else. It was a couple of years after, obviously. And then Winnie, it was quite fascinating. She began to write as if it was Angela's journal to get into the character.
There's something about Sunday night that really makes you want to kill yourself, especially if you've just been totally made a fool of by the only person you'll ever love, and you have a geometry midterm on Monday, which you still haven't studied for, because you can't, because Brian Krakow has your textbook, and you're too embarrassed to even deal with it. And your little sister's completely finished with her homework, which is just, like, so simple and mindless a child could do it.
Mom, Dad, I finished my report on crustaceans!
And that creepy 60 Minutes watch that sounds like your whole life ticking away.
And then she showed it to us. And we looked at it, we said, Winnie, this is the show.
You say that the only true way to measure the success of a movie is through time. So if you applied that scale to my so-called life, how would it fare?
Well, I would say to you that every 35-year-old girl in America, every interesting 35 or 39-year-old girl in America was really moved by it. I can pretty much predict that that's going to be a common theme. But the real thing is how it has continued. It still exists on Hulu, and there are still people seeing it, and you can never predict. That's a show that we only shot 17 episodes over 2 years, and yet has had this life of 30 years. I think because adolescence is one of those eternal, evergreen stories.
In 2010, you returned to the rom-com genre with Love and Other Drugs. It starred Anne Hathaway and Jake Gyllenhaal. You were going through a life crisis as you were making it. How did you deal with that?
Everything in life changes you. Love changes you. Good fortune changes you. And sickness changes you. And yet these all came together at the same time, where I had just gone through a very serious illness at the time that I was making a movie, coincidentally, about someone going through a very serious illness. It lent it a certain gravitas, but it also was full of joy for me because I was better. And I was looking upon all of that opportunity as a kind of blessing, as a kind of, I said I felt like I was playing with house money. I'd never been so happy working. And that experience with them was great for that reason.
And you're still doing well? You've fully recovered?
Thank you. Yeah. I mean, it's not something that you ever, that phrase when you're driving a car and you say objects in the mirror may be closer than they appear. Well, it's kind of like that with illness when you've had something that can recur. And it has recurred and it's also been dealt with again. So
that's great.
That's my life.
Yeah. You kept meticulous notebooks throughout your entire life, and that must have been very helpful in writing your memoir. I'm curious, though, what will your notebook next year say?
Wow. Well, I'm about to take this book tour, you know, and I'm doing these kind of conversations. You know, writing the book posed interesting questions that I had to ask of myself. Can I be authentic? Am I capable of looking at things with some objectivity, and can I be dispassionate about telling the truth about things? And sometimes that meant things that were hurtful. Sometimes it meant things that were shameful. Sometimes it meant things that were self-glorifying. But I was just determined to see if I could do that. And to the best of my ability, I tried.
Yeah. Ed Zwick, thank you very much for joining us today. Congratulations on Hits, Flops, and Other Illusions, My 40-something Years in Hollywood. It's a fascinating behind-the-scenes look at the trials and tribulations of life as a movie director.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Ed Zwick is an award-winning director, writer, and producer. He's also the author of Hits, Flops, and Other Illusions, My 40-something Years in Hollywood. Find out more about Ed at WPR.org/beta.
No one from MSNBC, by the way, ever called to apologize or check in on me. It was pretty pretty crazy.
Coming up, comedian Lori Kilmartin joins us to talk about going viral for all the wrong reasons and her stand-up special, Cis Woke Grief Slut. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.